Good morning. 6 minutes after 9 o'clock. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn again today on the Ideas Network. It's Monday. It's the 9 o'clock hour. That means it's all things political. I have to say, this is the year for the political junkie, because no matter where you look, there are great stories to talk about. On the international scene, you had President Bush visiting NATO last week, kind of a swan song there, and coming back with a mixed bag, some wins, some losses, and then going on to his final meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The difference being that Putin will stay in power in a way. He's expected to be prime minister and head of the political party that he's affiliated with. Anyway, and then that's just the international scene. Of course, lots to talk about on the national level with the presidential race in full swing, and even some things to talk about at the state of Wisconsin level. Frank Boyle, the leading liberal voice in the Wisconsin State Assembly, is calling it quits after 22 years. So, lots to talk about, and I'm going to give the phone numbers right now and urge you to call early and often. Here are the numbers, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And in Milwaukee, it's a local call for you, 227-2050, 227-2050. You can even send us an email. Here's the address, talk, it's a Monday morning, talk@wpr.org. And I was writing those down as I was saying them to make sure I said them slow enough so that you could get them too. And I'll repeat them during the hour. Okay, let's get to our guest and get things started. Joining me by telephone this morning is Michael Parkin, Assistant Professor of Politics at Oberlin College. Good morning, Professor. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Good morning.
So, boy, I don't even know where to start. There are so many great stories here to talk about. Let's go international first and talk about President Bush's trip to NATO and then his meeting with President Putin, his soulmate there in Russia. It's interesting to me that, again, pretty much every president in the last year of his term starts to focus on foreign policy. There's probably a really good reason for that, and in this case, it might just be to keep the president out of the country during the presidential race.
It could be that, but I think moreover, it's probably the idea that the president, as he nears the end of his term, really wants to set his legacy. And this current president has a bit of work to do on his legacy. So he might be particularly interested in going overseas and getting some foreign policy victories, particularly this one with missile defense in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, the missile defense, that was the big win, NATO has added to itself a little bit, but they decided to forego giving a plan of action to the Ukraine and Georgia, and that was probably the one big item on President Bush's agenda that they weren't successful on. But otherwise, it looked like a pretty successful, if a bit contentious, NATO meeting for President Bush.
Yeah, it's a little bit strange that he was able to get the missile defense, because it's my understanding that it was going to be Putin who was going to be quite upset with the missile defense, and yet he was able to get a victory on that. But as you mentioned, not get a victory on sort of in the enlargement of NATO, which I think would have been sort of less objectionable to Putin. But, you know, take victories where you can get them, I suppose.
Well, there you go. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back in the United States, we had lots to talk about. Well, let's go down my list here, and these aren't in any specific order as far as importance. It's just as they popped into my mind here this morning. Hillary and Bill Clinton released their tax returns for the last 10 years. I don't get it. What is all the big deal about presidential candidates releasing their tax returns? Why do we care?
Yeah, I have to admit that I don't really fully understand this either. My sense was that the Obama camp was sort of pressing for these because they were suspicious that maybe some bad news for Clinton would come out of it. But as far as I can tell, the Clinton campaign has dealt with this pretty well. I should come to, you know, no surprise to many people that Bill Clinton in particular has done very well on the speaking tour since leaving office. But, you know, I think in a society, you know, a capitalist society like ours, I mean, if people do well financially, that doesn't necessarily, you know, surprise many of us, particularly people who have been in high office before.
Okay, so the last year of the Clinton presidency, their combined income was less than $400,000. I don't remember the exact number, and it's really not relevant. And since then, they've done very well by themselves. Well, you know, bravo. It's no surprise that they make more money than I do. The surprise would be if they didn't. You know, name a former president who didn't do extremely well after leaving office. I mean, look at Ronald Reagan and the millions of dollars in speaking fees he racked up. Mm-hmm. And well, hey, great. You know, good for you. You put up with all the crap of being president, and there's got to be quite a bit. So now you get to cash in. Why should anyone care?
And I think, you know, particularly for the Clintons, I mean, the public has known that they have these big book deals. We always knew that they were going to make a lot of money off of that. We'd also heard, you know, some rumors about how much Bill Clinton was being paid per speaking engagement. And, you know, by all accounts, he's a very good public speaker. So, you know, why wouldn't you pay this guy a lot of money? I think the Obama camp was trying to go a little bit deeper and trying to have some evidence come out that where did all this money come from, and maybe there's, you know, a donor or two or somebody who paid a paycheck to one of the Clintons that may cause a problem for the campaign. But as far as I could tell, the releases didn't go that far, and so we really don't know where all this money is coming from. Now, that doesn't mean that investigative journalists and political operatives aren't going to dig a little bit deeper. I mean, indeed they might. But I think, you know, in the short term, over the past couple of days, this has really worked out quite well for the Clinton campaign.
And not to belabor the point, but I mean, why would we care where John McCain gets his money from? Why would we care where John McCain is a member of the United States Senate, so is Hillary Clinton. They get paid a salary. Their spouses are both worth more than they are. John McCain's wife is connected to through her father, I believe, is connected somehow to Anheuser-Busch.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of money there. They help finance his early political campaigns. So what? Same thing with Senator Obama. I mean, why do we where this has become something that's become routine for candidates to release their income tax returns over the last, I don't know how many years here. And I don't understand. I'm still trying to figure out why we even bother with that. Who cares?
Well, because I think for the Clinton example, I can't remember the name of the company, but he invested in some company and has made quite a bit of money off of that investment. And there's some question about that company's dealings and who their kind of subsidiaries are. Now, I don't know the exact details of it, but, you know, it sort of passed the first test in the sense that people, you know, the people that I was talking to said, you know, there may be something there, but if we don't see it by now, we're probably not going to see it. The other thing that I think is quite interesting about this is that, I mean, even Obama, who, you know, probably has given the impression that he's, you know, the less kind of the least wealthy out of all of them. I mean, I was a little surprised when this Resco story came up. The idea that a person who's a community organizer is, you know, making land dealings and investing in property. Like, I don't know. I guess I have an image of people who have land dealings as having a little bit more money than those of us who don't speculate in real estate. But so I think you're right. I think for all of these politicians, they're talented people, and we should expect them to do well financially.
Yeah, I guess a bigger knock would be if you didn't do well financially.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
What kind of money manager are you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on. The superdelegates is still perhaps one of the dominating features of the Democratic presidential race, and more news about that over the last few days as many superdelegates are interviewed and talking about who they're going to support. It looks to a lot of political observers, I guess, that the only way that Senator Clinton can win the Democratic nomination is somehow at the convention if the superdelegates go her way. What's play out the scenarios there for us of what Obama has to do now and what Clinton has to do going forward over these next couple of months?
Well, I have to admit that I don't think the superdelegates are quite the problem that the media makes them out to be. Most of the superdelegates have refused to commit, and they're smart in doing so in the sense that they just honestly don't know who's going to win, and they're politicians. They want to back the winner. So what I think is probably going to happen is that ultimately, it's going to be the remaining nine states and Puerto Rico that are ultimately going to put one of the candidates, probably Obama, out in front. And as soon as he looks like he's in the clear, you're going to see just a tidal wave of superdelegates go to him. And then ultimately, at the convention, it's not going to be a problem. The more likely problem scenario is that if Clinton manages to keep this really, really close all the way to the end of the primaries, in that case, then the superdelegates are ultimately going to have to cast their vote one way or the other. And I would venture a guess that most of them are going to cast a vote for the candidate who is either leading, pardon me, either leading in the number of states or in the popular vote or by any criteria like that. So I think ultimately in the end, this will work itself out. But the media sure seems to be spending a lot of time and attention on that. And that's possibly because they've had, you know, kind of 6 weeks or at this point, 3 weeks or 4 weeks without a primary. So they're kind of looking for things to talk about.
Speaking of primaries, a new poll out shows Senator Obama has moved inside the double-digit mark in terms of how far he's behind Senator Clinton in Pennsylvania. It's a state that Clinton would have expected. It's expected that she would win, and the question is going to be by how much. How much does she need to win by to really make a statement there that she should be the choice of the superdelegates?
Well, I think she needs probably a double-digit victory there, because if it's inside single digits, she's looking at only a net gain of, say, 7 or 8 delegates, which is really not enough. She needs to make up more ground than that. But it's been the history of these primaries that she has held very large leads in a number of states until Obama hits the ground. And then when he hits the ground, he starts to chip away at that support, and sometimes he's been able to eventually win. Here in Ohio, you know, he chipped away at it a little bit, but Clinton was still able to win by quite a large margin. But I think, given that we've had this long campaign in Pennsylvania, you know, 5 or 6 weeks, it gives Obama a little bit more time. The key thing about Pennsylvania as well is that the delegates are distributed sort of based on population, and Obama is going to do quite well in the Philadelphia area, which is going to get him kind of a disproportionate number of delegates. Whereas Clinton's going to win a lot of the area in Pennsylvania, her delegate jump or gain is not going to be quite as strong as maybe she had hoped.
And Obama has changed his campaigning tactics a little bit in Pennsylvania, going away from the big speeches in front of the large rallies and that kind of thing, and doing more of the face-to-face kind of in-the-trenches sort of politicking. And do you think that strategy is going to pay off for him?
I think it's a very interesting strategy, and I'm particularly interested in what it means for the future of his campaign. Certainly, he had a winning strategy with these large sort of rock star appearances, but something in the campaign or something somewhere suggested that he try this more intimate setting. By all accounts, he's fairly talented at these intimate settings as well, so it may be just that he's broadening his strategy. I would think that would be a better idea than trying to completely go to these smaller events and kind of do away with this strategy that was working so well for them. I mean, it's also possibly the case that he realizes that he wants to try to get some votes outside of the Philadelphia area, and in some of those locations, a more kind of intimate setting like a bowling alley may actually work a little bit better for those types of events.
Well, and some people are talking about the idea that Obama needs to prove that he can win with he can go toe to toe with Senator Clinton in the with blue collar white male voters.
Yeah, I think that's essentially it as well. Now, that's not to say that blue collar white voters aren't kind of jazzed up at a rally as well, but I think it is the case that if you kind of have these more intimate settings, you may attract more of them. And moreover, you may actually have a better shot at actually convincing them to support his candidacy. And this may be something that the campaign is kind of trying out to see how well it goes, and to, if they make it to the general election, something that they'll continue to use as part of a broadening strategy rather than totally replacing this large events that he's quite good at.
We're at break time. We'll take a little time out here. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls. Here are your numbers, and there are still some lines open for you if you want to call right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, It's a local call for you, so please use 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We also have an email address. Feel free to send us a message, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. It's All Things Political for a Monday, April 7th, 2008. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:23. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up a little bit later. 80,000 workers lost their jobs in the United States last month after five on At Issue. Ben Marins talks with the New York Times workplace correspondent about what's happened to the working economy. That's after five today on At Issue here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's All Things Political, as we take a look at the political news of the last week, and certainly the unemployment numbers or the job loss numbers were political news. 80,000 jobs lost in the last month. Who does that help or hurt, Professor? I'm trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I don't see it really helping anybody anywhere. On the one hand, you have John McCain, who has sort of suggested that the economy is not his strongest suit. He's also made an interesting speech in which he basically said that, you know, these jobs are gone and they're not coming back. And then on the Democratic side, you have two candidates who, you know, with Clinton, who supported NAFTA originally, which is now being blamed for a lot of the job loss, particularly in my area here in Ohio, and Obama, who many people simply say that this guy just lacks the experience to be able to get us out of an economic problem, and really a free fall that we're starting to find ourselves in. So it certainly hurts the vast majority of Americans, but it also, I don't think it helps any of the campaigns in any clear way. In fact, it probably hurts all of the campaigns equally, I would imagine.
Speaking of free trade agreements, Senator Clinton lost another campaign advisor this week because he was caught having dealings with the Colombian ambassador over a trade agreement that Clinton opposes. This is a continuing story in the Clinton camp with people leaving. How big is this?
Well, I mean, the thing that comes to my mind when I hear about this is, you're right, it sort of goes with these other stories that we've heard about troubles in the Clinton campaign. But what's amazing to my mind about this is how little we hear from the Obama campaign. I mean, let's remember, Clinton's supposed to be the experienced one. Obama was supposed to be this guy that kind of came out of nowhere, never really done this before, never had to run a tough race. I mean, he's, in terms of his advisors, he's running a nearly flawless campaign. We don't hear any of these rumors about infighting from the Obama camp, or at least I don't. Whereas it seems that within the Clinton camp, part of the problem, I would suggest, is that when you are a Clinton and you have a number of people who are very, very good people, very good campaign strategists, they know that they're very good, and that tends to get egos kind of involved with things, and a lot of infighting can take over. Ultimately, it really hurts the campaign. And moreover, it's sort of a sports analogy. When the team starts to lose, the team also starts to turn on each other. And that's, I think, part of what's happening in the Clinton campaign. This thing with Mark Penn, I have to admit, I just completely don't understand what this guy's thinking. You're working on a presidential campaign. You're given this position of great authority in the campaign, and you're off having lunch with a Colombian ambassador, knowing that your candidate is going to be upset about this. I have to wonder what he was thinking. Was he potentially thinking, you know, maybe this Clinton presidency thing isn't going to work out and I need to cover my bases on other things? Or did he just not understand that the candidate was going to be this upset with him? I tend to think it's probably the first rather than the second, but I have no evidence of that, so I'm just sort of speculating at this point.
One of the stories about this issue of Mark Penn, who was the staffer, he was actually the chief strategist for the Clinton campaign leaving, referred to President Bush and Karl Rove. And when Karl Rove came to work for President Bush's campaign, President Bush made him drop all of his other clients. In other words, the Bush campaign was his only client at that point, and that perhaps the purpose of that was to prevent any kind of incident like the one that Mark Penn ran into. Interestingly enough, Mark Penn said that his lunch with the Colombian ambassador was an error in judgment, at which point the Colombians got mad and dropped his firm as their PR firm.
It was kind of a real lose-lose situation. Yeah,
it was a bad day for Mark Penn, and there were some people who said, "Well, good riddance. This guy is the architect of a losing strategy anyway."
Yeah, I mean, like really, I mean, I don't mean to be highly critical of Mark Penn, but quite frankly, when you're running a not so successful campaign, and if you're making errors in judgment about your own personal life, who's to say you're going to make, you know, not make the same errors in judgment in terms of the campaign? And quite frankly, when you're the candidate, you can't have that from senior staff. I sort of can understand where Bush might have told Rove, you know, drop everything else. I think the Penn story is a little bit more interesting in the sense that, I mean, he knew that by talking to the Colombians, this was going to potentially one day be brought up by somebody who could make Clinton look like she's, you know, speaking out of both sides of her mouth. And he had to have known that, and yet he still did it, which is just even more perplexing to my mind.
Well, there really are no secrets anymore.
Yeah.
So, people need, it's a new world. Let's go to the phones and take some calls. We've got some people who are waiting to jump in on our discussion. And we'll go first to Jeff in Winneconne. Jeff, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just have to correct you a little bit. The tax returns were not released for 2007. They released from 2000 to 2006, and there was a lot of stuff in there that was questionable. 2007 is the ones that we want to look at, that everyone wants to look at. They made an extraordinary amount of money, and we really want to know where that money went to. I'm talking about the Clintons, of course.
Clarify that for me. They made an extraordinary amount of money. If we haven't seen their tax returns, how do we know that?
Well, that's what the predictions are. A lot of reporting and a lot of media is already reporting.
Other than
that,
the media,
you know, that everyone wants to look at 2007. That's the most interesting year.
When you say everyone, who do you mean?
Us.
Why? I'm still trying to figure out what difference it makes, because this is still terra incognita for me. What do you think you're going to find when you see their 2007 tax, assuming their tax returns have been filed? I know mine aren't yet. What do you think is there?
A lot of donations from questionable people. There's already been three persons that they were getting money from that are questionable.
You mean money for the campaign?
Money for different business operations that they've done over since 2007 to 2006. And we all want to know what's on 2007. Lou Dobbs said that. Chris Matthews said that. We want to know what's in 2007.
Okay, well, maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't.
Yeah.
Is that going to make a difference whether or not, let's say that Hillary Clinton becomes the Democratic nominee, would her failure to release a 2007 tax return, if she decides not to, affect how you would vote?
Oh, yeah, definitely. She's already sounding really crooked to me. There's a lot of things that I need to look at, and you know, I don't really want a Bush Clinton.
Okay, so what it sounds to me like is that even if she released her income tax returns for 2007 and there was nothing there, you wouldn't vote for her anyway.
No, I wouldn't vote for her anyway. But I need, and the American public needs to know. And why is she suppressing that information? This doesn't make any sense to me. If she's running for our president, we can't trust her.
Okay, I still don't get it, but maybe I'm just dense.
You are.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I've been told that before. I think, I don't know, do you want to comment on this any further? Professor?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I think the caller is right to an extent that the onus is really on Hillary Clinton to put out the information that she has. However, I sort of disagree. I think, I mean, this information, the information that she did put out, came out on Friday, as I understand it. And if she was able to get through the weekend and possibly get through today without there being a lead story about, you know, donations come in from this person X who we should all be concerned about, or business dealings with this company have been, you know, somewhat, you know, curious, I think that she's weathered the information throughout the weekend suggests that there may not be as much kind of salacious information in there as many people would suspect. But I do agree with the caller that if you're running for president, you have an obligation to put these things out there. I just think that she might have done that, and it may be less sort of exciting or interesting or scandalous than we thought it might be.
Let's go next to Jim in Waupun. Jim was on a cell phone. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Okay. I would think we need to take a very close look at President Clinton's income, particularly in terms of speaking engagements. What bothers me is that officials leave office and then they become wealthy, as in the case of Ronald Reagan with his speaking remunerations and Clinton. We live in a very sophisticated age of critical analysis, so people have to be very careful at those upper levels. And I wouldn't say it's a quid pro quo, but I would say that the passage of NAFTA alone would make many in the large corporate business community very appreciative of Mr. Clinton having done that. And so I would like to know who he spoke to and how much he got paid, what organizations paid him. I'm very concerned about that in terms of Tommy Thompson, too, because he's now a member of many boards. And during his long tenure in Wisconsin, he did a lot of favorable things for large business. And it isn't exactly a quid pro quo, but it makes me very suspicious and very concerned. And I'll hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Jim. Well, it's certainly, if you look at the careers of some of the top lobbyists in Washington, D.C., for example, quite a few of them were fairly powerful members of Congress at one time. And, you know, there's apparently nothing illegal about parlaying your work for the government into a post-government income. And again, I'm still trying to figure out some of the significance of this.
Yeah, I would agree that, you know, what you were saying earlier about this idea that these men and women, when they do public service, they do give up a certain degree of income that they probably could have been doing a little bit better as lawyers or as business people. But they know that going in. And this idea of them, quote-unquote, cashing in after they leave, I mean, these are successful people. If you're a successful politician and a lobbying firm wants to hire you, for example, they want to hire you for your connections and for your skills. And this is politics, and that's what's valuable. In terms of speaking engagements, if you're a persuasive speaker, many corporations may bring you in to talk to their executives to give some insight on how to run something as large as the United States government. And I don't necessarily think that this is always a bad thing. When people leave the Oval Office, they have every right to go after income in any way that they want to. And if I were to leave my job and go to a different job, I may have connections from the first job and that help me secure more income. These people are trying to make money just like any of us would. I mean, granted, they have some pretty incredible opportunities that most of us don't have. But that's kind of been the way it's been for a very long time. This is nothing all that new, I wouldn't suggest.
Well, and let's face it, Bill Clinton is a popular figure in American politics. In spite of everything that happened during his tenure as president of the United States, he's a two-term president, a dynamic speaker. And, you know, if your organization had the cash to hire him to come and speak at your convention, wouldn't you? I don't know.
The other thing, too, is that a lot of this money, particularly from the Clintons, is coming from book deals. So, you know, it's a publisher that's basically saying, we're interested in your story. We're going to pay you this many millions of dollars to tell the story because, guess what? We know that the American population will buy your book. So it's in that case, it's the average, you know, Joe that's buying the book, not some corporate CEO who's bringing you in to talk. Of course, there are the talks as well, but
well,
they made a lot of money from these books as well.
And nobody's going to buy my book. I can't even get published, so
The Clinton story is particularly, both Clintons, their story is something that many Americans want to read or are quite interested in.
Okay, let's drop this subject and move on. I think this horse is dead and we can quit beating it now. Let's go next to Paul, who's calling us on a cell phone. Paul, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Friday, page 810 of the front section of the New York Times, they had a picture of the NATO leaders. They're posing, getting ready to pose for their official portrait. Everybody is sort of standing there. And there's probably 15 people in the picture. George Bush is down center front where the United States should be, but everybody else is looking someplace else. No one's talking to him. The group on the left are all sort of huddled on one side. The group on the right were all sort of huddled on the other, and he was, you know, literally all by himself. And I thought that was possibly the greatest editorial picture I'd ever seen. That the idea that he was successful coming out of NATO. I mean, how many extra? We're sending a handful. The NATO leaders agreed to send a handful of troops to Afghanistan, but when those troops get there, they're not going to be in combat. They're going to go to nice, safe areas, and then American troops are going to be put into combat. And we've got nothing going on, you know, our support for Iraq or for anything else. All the things that are on the front burner right now, we got basically nothing. So I think that how you summarized the NATO summit before was incorrect. These guys are just waiting for him to leave so they can deal with somebody else next year.
Okay, I stand corrected. Professor?
Well, I would say that the symbolism in the picture is quite interesting, and I think you're right. But it still begs the question, how was he able to get any agreement on anything? Granted, if these foreign troops are going to go into Afghanistan and not really do much, I mean, why send them at all? If it's in fact the case that they just want to ignore Bush and not give him anything, then they would have given him nothing. I mean, they did give him something, and there had to be some reason why they... You know, maybe they gave him something because they knew that he's on his way out. I think it's a little too harsh to say that he got nothing from this NATO meeting. He did get something. It may not have been everything he wanted to get. But, you know, we have to be fair. He got something out of it.
Well, the big thing he got was the agreement on the missile defense system. Mm-hmm. That was probably the main thing, and there's still Chancellor Merkel. It was interesting. Chancellor Merkel was not happy with President Bush on a couple of issues. Chancellor Merkel from Germany, and that was a pretty spirited discussion. So I guess it remains to be seen who succeeded and who failed. There. Let me give the phone numbers again and encourage people to call. We have a line available for you right now if you want to call in. What was your top political story of the week and why? Don't worry, it's not a quiz. It won't be a grade. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. It's a toll-free number. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you, so please use 414-227-2050. 227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@WisconsinPublicRadio. That's WPR.org. My guest this morning, Michael Parkin, assistant professor of politics at Oberlin College. And it's All Things Political for Monday, April the 7th, 2008. You can call in with your questions or comments, and what did you think was the top story, or what was your favorite political story of the week? We'll bring up one more topic, and then we'll go to a break as the phones are starting to light up here. John McCain the story last week, he was mulling the idea of who his vice presidential running mate should be, and... what did you think of that? Who do you think of the people who have been mentioned? And I don't have the list in front of me. There were a number of names that popped up last week. What does McCain need in a running mate, and who do you think can deliver it for him?
Well, I think McCain needs a couple of things. The first thing that he needs, given that he's been, you know, a very long-term senator, is I think all of these candidates, as being senators, they require somebody who can honestly say, I've actually run something of my own. And in many cases, we're talking about a governor there. So I think McCain may be leaning towards a governor, and particularly a governor who has strong skills in terms of the economy, because that's one place that McCain is very, very strong on foreign policy. And I don't know that he would really feel the need to duplicate his strengths on foreign policy. But he may feel the need to have a successful governor come in who has, you know, had some, pardon me, economic success. So some of the key people that come up would be sort of Minnesota's Pawlenty or even Huckabee or even Romney, although I'm not sure that he gets along with Romney quite well enough. But, I mean, Mitt Romney has had some economic successes that he could bring to the table, and he's also, you know, been a governor. So he can add to the ticket this idea that he's successfully run something of his own, whereas, you know, senators typically build up their skills in terms of foreign policy. So those are kind of the type of people that I think McCain would be looking for. But it's probably a fairly long list at this point, I would think.
Let's take a call next from Larry, who's on a cell phone. Larry, good morning.
Yes, a brief comment. Jimmy Carter left office as probably one of the least appreciated presidents, has done a tremendous amount of good, and I think even though he's gotten a lot of money for public speaking, it almost all goes to the Carter Center and his foundation, and I sort of respect him for that. One of the comment I wanted to make was, why is the press continuing to say that Hillary Clinton won Texas? She did win the popular vote, but after the caucuses were done there, it's my understanding that Barack Obama came out with more delegates. And so since delegates decide who the nominee is going to be, why aren't we saying that Obama won Texas?
That's an excellent question, Professor. Why aren't we saying that Obama won in Texas?
Yeah, that is a very, very good question. I mean, to be probably much more cynical than I ought to be, good luck trying to explain what happened in Texas. I mean, if you really sat down and asked somebody, okay, how does the primary/caucus work in Texas? It's extremely complicated, and it's not a story that the media can very quickly explain to viewers. But that doesn't excuse them from not, you know, saying, well, you know, she did win, you know, in terms of the primary part of it, but in terms of the caucus part of it, Obama won, and at the end of the day, the delegates went more for Obama. If I remember correctly, it took some time for Texas to figure out exactly the delegate count, and maybe by the time, the 2 or 3 days afterwards, maybe by that time, the press was just sort of thought it was yesterday's story and didn't go for it. I have to agree that that is an excellent question.
Well, I think it's another example of where the press nowadays doesn't really do their job.
Yeah, I would you get some agreement on that from me, for sure.
I'll only get in trouble if I comment on that. So, Larry, thank you so much for the call. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have some more people who want to join us by phone, and you can too, 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. In my next hour, returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan face many obstacles, but my guests after 10 are trying to alleviate one of them by training veterans for new careers. And we'll have a number of guests and some really interesting projects to talk about after 10 o'clock this morning, so stick around. This hour, it's All Things Political. My guest is Michael Parkin, Assistant Professor of Politics at Oberlin College, and we'll go back to the phones now and take a call from Mike in Appleton. Mike, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I'd ask the professor to leap forward in time here towards the November elections and what he feels external influences, and when I mean external, I mean not U.S., but, you know, outside influences will be on the election in the following sense. How much influence does he think Iran is going to put to ratchet up problems in Iraq as the elections get closer? And does the absence of any terrorist activity in the U.S. mean that they're kind of biding their time and not wanting to stir up trouble.
I think I'm, as a professor, notoriously bad at projecting forward or trying to predict the future at all, but I'll entertain the question anyways. I think external factors always play a role in the minds of voters, even if nothing is really, you know, apparently happening. I think we always think that, you know, maybe there's not a terrorist attack happening right now, but there could be, and so that's going to be there. Now, certainly, if there is some external event, a large event that takes place, I think it has to help the McCain candidacy over the two Democrats, whichever Democrat would be in power there, just simply because of his experience in foreign policy and the idea that he gives off, you know, pretty strong positions dealing with foreign entities. So even if nothing happens, I think any time that the McCain campaign brings out foreign policy issues, it's going to help their campaign. But certainly if something major were to occur, I have to believe that it's going to push a number of voters who may be kind of in the middle towards McCain and towards this idea of a stronger defense.
Mike, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Tom in Madison.
Yeah, hi.
Tom, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'd just like to comment on that the guy that called in and talked about the picture that was in the New York Times about how seemingly President Bush was being ostracized by all the other members of NATO. That goes right to the left-leaning bias of the press and why people like me get frustrated with it. That was a photo that was taken before the group shoot. That's what they were doing, was setting up for the group shoot. And everybody is looking for their spot where they're supposed to stand. That's what's going on. President Bush had already found his spot and was standing on it. And the photo appears to be of a bunch of people ignoring President Bush and conferring amongst one another when all they're doing is looking for the spot where they're supposed to stand. Bush's success in NATO is typified, I think, by countries that have been hostile to the United States for a long time, France especially, who has done all they could to thwart our attempts from way back when President Reagan wanted to send planes to Libya and wouldn't let them fly over their airspace. I think that was a significant move that now you have France supporting our efforts there. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Tom, thanks for that call.
Yeah,
as photos go, I didn't see the photo in question, but I think Tom's explanation is perfectly logical as far as, you know, this was shot when people were trying to figure out where they were supposed to stand.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, we've certainly seen a number of photos that are like that. And this brings up a number of interesting questions that I try to deal with in my own research, which is, first of all, when the New York Times decides to pick that picture over the more kind of formal picture, what is their motivation there? Is it explicitly biased, as the caller suggests, or is it more the case that they think it's a more interesting picture, or is it the case that it's kind of implicitly biased, that they think it's a more interesting picture, and then somewhere deep down in their psyche they realize that it has a certain effect, but they don't consciously understand that? But for voters, you know, reading the New York Times and seeing that picture, it's interesting that two of the callers get a sense of the story from the picture, and it's two very different senses of the story. One caller believes that it suggests that Bush was unsuccessful, and the other caller believes that it's part of the media bias. And I think that's what's actually interesting about this, is that two independent people can see the exact same picture and see two very different things, largely based on their preconceived ideas of the story itself. So in that way, regardless of whether it's intended to be biased or not, voters still have a mind of their own, and they can still look at these pictures and come up with their own interpretations based on what they already know about politics. So in a sense, you know, bias is only really effective if we as voters are not very sort of media savvy and picking up on these things. I think it's an interesting topic, but one that you know, we have to remind ourselves that voters play an important role in this as well.
Well, then Tom's comments about our relationship with France and the recent election there has certainly caused a big change in that area, with a more conservative person at the helm of the French government now than ever before. Charles de Gaulle has to be rolling over in his grave right now in terms of that situation. And so point well taken there. Let's go next to Roman in Wausau.
Good morning. I was listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, I believe it was Saturday, and it was indicated that the superdelegate from Montana is going to allow his vote to go according to what his border collie tells him to do. I find it interesting that if the vote is even at the convention, that our next president may be selected by a dog in Montana. This superdelegate situation, I would still like to have somebody explain it to me, where they come from, who appoints them.
Well, first of all, before Professor Parkin answers your question, I should say Trish McConnell would tell you that border collies are extremely smart animals. So that'll be my contribution to your answer, and I'll leave the hard part of that to Michael Parkin. Professor?
Yeah, I think we're all kind of scratching our heads a little bit about the superdelegates. It's my understanding that the superdelegates are basically elected officials and high-ranking party officials who are given a single vote at the convention as well. And the reason behind it is not entirely clear to me why, unlike the Republican Party, why the Democrats feel it's necessary to have both rank-and-file members and kind of these higher-ups cast a vote as well. I suppose it's because they want to have the ability to sort of override the rank-and-file members, or it could be that they want to show that the rank-and-file members have a kind of an equal standing with the kind of higher-ups in the party.
Well,
it's interesting, and if somebody, I hadn't heard this story about the border collie, but if somebody comes out and says that they're going to cast their vote on a border collie, I mean, I really hope that they're just joking, because I don't know if you noticed, but there's a couple wars going on and a failing economy. This stuff's a little too serious to be, suggesting that we're going to pick the president based on what your border collie says.
Well, maybe the border collie knows more than the rest of us.
It's possible.
You have to. And actually, as far as the superdelegates are concerned, the reason for their existence, two words, George McGovern.
Yeah.
And I think that that was covered fairly early on in the campaign when the superdelegate story first started to pop up. And the Democratic Party had decided they didn't want another 1972. And so the superdelegates were supposed to be a balance to somebody who was really outside the box coming in and taking the nomination, as George McGovern did that in that case.
But it begs the question that in 2008, why do we still have superdelegates? In 2012, is the Democratic Party still going to have superdelegates after all of the potential problems that this may have caused? They may rethink that. I don't know.
You bet. We'll see. Yeah, and that'll be fodder for another political program on Wisconsin Public Radio, no doubt. Let's go next to Bob in Claybanks. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having the show today. My original call was on Ron Paul, but I wanted to resuscitate this dead horse that I think you euthanized a little early. As far as the candidates' tax returns, they make decisions that involve certain businesses, and I think it behooves us to pay attention to where some of their contributions come from while they're in office and where this money might come from after they've left office. I think there's enough opportunities for most politicians to make money without doing things that seem to be a conflict of interest by taking money from a company that they've worked on passing some legislation for while they were in office. And I wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Bob, thanks for that call. Well, the horse is now standing on 4 feet, so let's take it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we go back to this concern that maybe, there's this idea that while you're in office, if you do favors for people, they'll thank you possibly when you're out of office. But, I go back to this idea that a lot of this money is, it's coming from book deals. Sure, there are these speeches, but I think some of these speeches, if we know exactly who it is that paid for these speaking engagements and how much they were paid. I mean, Bill Clinton got paid a lot for each engagement that he did. I think if you're a candidate and you've got nothing to hide, why not put it out there? It doesn't, if you got nothing to hide, it's not a big deal. The other thing that I think has happened more generally with this disclosure of the tax stuff is that we see that the Clintons gave, first of all, a lot of money to charity, which is...
It was like $10 million,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, good for them to do. And moreover, what strikes me as really strange is they did not take a lot of the kind of deductions that you would expect multimillionaires to take. I think they paid something like 31% tax rate, which is really pretty high for multimillionaires to pay that, because they usually have some pretty creative accountants that can get them out of a lot of stuff. And I think it speaks to the kind of political acumen of the Clintons to realize that they shouldn't be taking those shortcuts, because it'll probably hurt them in the end. Those are two interesting points that come out of this.
$33 million and change in taxes paid, I think, was the figure. It was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more money than I'll ever see.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I think we're about out of time here. Let's see. This has been an interesting hour, and I just want to leave us with what did you think, Professor, was the top political story of the week? Just give me one sentence on that, and then we'll get out of here.
I think the confirmation that 80,000 jobs were lost. I think that is a sign of things to come, and it could do a lot to shape the future of this campaign.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Parkin, for spending this hour. Very enjoyable. Michael Parkin is Assistant Professor of Politics at Oberlin College. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Mimi Notstein handled on-air production for us this morning. If you would like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program 47D. And you can also listen to the program again online at WPR.org. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.